This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by RPGNow.com, your leading source for PDF game products, and GamersAddict.com, where you get free swag and $3 off an order of $30 with the coupon code RADIO. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's RPG Shop affiliate link and our Amazon store.
VorpalNetwork.com.
This is David Nett, creator of Gold, the role-playing game web series that does double damage, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 111. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we're going to get rich with Gold, the series. This episode is officially time-traveling to you, the listener. While I might be recording it just before the 4th of July, it will be released to you weeks later while I'm in Africa and have no idea if it's actually working properly. It's like magic. Ooh, or not, whatever. But what is magic is Gold the Series, a web series about a group of people all focused on winning an upcoming role-playing tournament. And joining me for this episode is David Nett, executive producer and more for Gold the Series. Mr. Nett, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Before we get into the full discussion here, I wanted to bring up the first sponsor of the episode, RPGNow.com. If you want a PDF gaming product, then RPGNow.com is the way to go. My pick for this episode is Fantasy Class Martialist. This 74-page, under $9 PDF gives you a new martial striker for the 4th edition version of D&D that's focused on using light armor and fighting without weapons. They take a good stab at unarmed and grappling combat that hasn't been addressed in this version of the game yet, and they have some measure of success, I think. Plus, beyond the class, you get new paragon paths, epic destinies, magic items, optional rules, and they even do this awesome thing of providing you pages of power cards so you can print off all the powers to go along with the rest of your D&D stuff, which was a great idea. That's The Martialist from RPGNow.com. Find a link to it in the show notes. Now, our chit-chat with Mr. David Nett from Gold the Series. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm great, man. Thank you for having me here. Hey, I wanted to say I actually just downloaded that Martialist, which is totally a coincidence.
Whoa.
I've got a guy in my campaign who's a martial artist. Like, he's actually a martial artist, and he's playing a monk, and he's dissatisfied with how I'm dealing with it. So I downloaded that, the Martialist, to try to get some more ideas. I don't play 4E right now, but so I haven't read it yet, but, you know, it looks good to me.
I just got a review copy of it about 45 minutes ago, so I've skimmed through it. And it's got some ideas in there that 4th edition hasn't addressed yet. And I haven't read thoroughly enough to know whether or not it handles them well. So we'll see.
I'm excited to read it, though, because, like I said, I've got one of my players is right now grappling with, you know, his real-world training and what's in his monk class. So I'm hoping it'll help me out.
Right on.
Get the newest releases at RPG Now. Only at RPG Now can you get the absolute latest and best releases from fantastic publishers like Palladium Books and White Wolf Publishing. There are new products every single day. Come to RPGNow.com and get them the instant they're available.
So, before we get into your fun times with D&D, let's talk about Gold.
Great, thank you.
What is Gold? I mean, other than a precious metal.
The Gold the Series, the web series that I created, is it's a web series, sort of a combination of a satire of sports movies and television here in America. You know, movies like Hoosiers and Friday Night Lights and Any Given Sunday, and really a tribute to the tabletop role playing game community, which is a community that I love and a pastime that has been a passion of mine since I was a very young kid. So it's a web series about role-playing gamers. And to take it a step further, in order to make that kind of connection between the way that Americans love their sports and tabletop role-playing games, it's about professional role-playing gamers preparing for their upcoming role-playing version of the Super Bowl. They play a game called Goblins and Gold, which is a creation of the series so that we could take liberties with how the game was played and not worry about copyrights and stuff. And it follows the American and British teams, the Americans being the good guys because, you know, it's an American sports television show, and the British being the bad guys as they prepare for the tournament.
It's interesting that you would compare it to the to a sports show, because that, I mean, I hadn't really picked up on that very heavily watching it, but it makes a lot of sense now that you say it. You know, because you use enough analogy to real world things that, you know, the fact that the tournament is televised on G14, you know, and
things, I think actually the tournament is televised on QSPN.
Okay,
G14 is their competitor. But
okay.
Yeah.
But you know, there's enough sort of little things like that that it's like, oh, well, that kind of stuff kind of does happen, although not for role playing.
Right.
You know,
and we took a lot of the archetypes of the characters from sports movies. The character that I play, Jonathan Drake, is sort of like the injured quarterback, which is a staple of football movies, kind mm-hmm. of the hero leader of the team who becomes injured and can't play anymore. You know, Richard Wright is the maverick loose cannon player who must, you know, step up and grow up to learn how to lead a team. You know, there's a lot of those kind of sports archetypes that we've built in, and those sports movie storylines that we've built in, and they're not as overt as maybe a really kind of tongue in cheek broad comedy satire might be, but using those archetypes and applying them to the world that I live in, you know.
Sure. And so how did this concept of Gold the Series sort of come about? You know, did it start off as a larger project and then you turned it into a free web series, or was it always a web series in your mind? How did this concept come around in your head?
It was actually a short film that I wrote, or it started as a short film that I wrote about 5 or 6 years ago. I live out in Los Angeles and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was toying with the idea of shooting my own project. And this is 5 or 6, maybe 7 years ago, right when digital production started to be easy enough that you know, a person could do it without a lot of expensive gear. And so I wrote a short film that the basic premise of it was, what if Dungeons and Dragons were an Olympic sport? And so the short film took place entirely at the tournament. And it was, again, at the Olympics in the case of the short film. And as I was writing it, it just blossomed into this giant thing that I couldn't possibly shoot myself, with stadiums and, you know, cheering fans, and just the scope and scale of it became so huge that I was happy with what I'd written, but there was no way I could shoot it myself. So I shelved it. And then toward the end of 2007, I felt like it was time for me to do something on my own, and a web series was looking like a possibility. There were a few series that were starting to kind of break water and gather some fans. It became clear that people were going to watch content online. And so I dug this out of the drawer that it was in, or the electronic drawer. It was on my computer, and started to look at it to try to figure out how could this be something that I could present and distribute myself online. And the story leading up to, you know, kind of the final tournament was the story I thought would be interesting to tell.
So you've had some experience in film in the past, and looking through the cast list on the website, it looks like a lot of your cast and crew have as well. How did you end up with a cast and a crew that had that level of experience for something that I assume you guys are basically doing out of love and not really for any sort of pay?
Yeah, you assume right. I mean, technically, we're all getting paid, but it's deferred pay. A lot of the actors and crew are union members, either SAG or AFTRA or whatever. And we worked under a Screen Actors Guild contract, which was very important to me because I'm a Screen Actors Guild actor.
Sure.
But you know, the Screen Actors Guild acknowledges kind of the early stages of the independent web production, and so they have a lot of flexibility in their contract. So technically, everybody will get paid if we ever make money. The chances of us making money are small. But you know, I live in Los Angeles. I'm an actor and a writer. I've run a small theater company for almost 8 years now, along with some of my friends. And so I'm just fortunate to have over the years gathered a large number of really talented friends. You know, honestly, Gold was really a right place at the right time thing. If I had tried to do it 4 or 5 years earlier, technologically, it would have been rough. Plus, you know, I wouldn't have known all these great people. And there are a handful of people in the cast and crew that I didn't know before we started. We auditioned for a few roles, and we had to go out and find some of our behind-the-scenes people. But mostly, these are people who I'm fortunate enough to be friends with, who were willing to, you know, grab the reins of a passion project essentially and you know, go down this kind of really exhausting, it turns out, and time-consuming struggle with me. So I feel very, very lucky. The friends that I have out here, it wouldn't have been possible without them. So
sure. Now, and you mentioned that the game that they're playing is it Goblins and Gold?
Yes.
Because you essentially wanted to avoid copyright entanglements, although it's pretty clear from watching it that they're playing D&D.
Yeah, well, yeah. And, you know, for me, Dungeons & Dragons was my game. I mean, I played, you know, dozens and dozens of role-playing games over the years. I started playing when I was in junior high, which is too many years ago to count. And I played dozens of games over the year. But Dungeons & Dragons was the game that I started with, and it's really honestly the game that I love. And, you know, I started playing with first edition and then moved into second edition. And that's really that's where my heart is more than anything. And, it, you know, when you're working with copyrighted material, you know, a company like Wizards of the Coast or even TSR before they were Wizards of the Coast, it's a dicey thing. We're treating the game with a lot of respect, I think. I have a deep love for the game. Mm-hmm. At the same time, when you if we were to try to get use of a copyrighted game, even if they allowed us to, there's a lot of creative intervention that they would have to have, you know, just in order to protect their copyright, which makes absolute sense. You don't want people to make fun of or you know, abuse this thing that, you know, that you are running for money. And so we ultimately, as we were talking about creating the series, decided that it was better for us to have the freedom of a game that belongs to us. And so Goblins and Gold was created, and we built kind of just like a loose, you know, framework for the rules so that we would have a consistency as we reference stuff. And actually, if you watch the show closely enough, you'll see we actually break our own consistency on occasion.
Yeah.
Because the scripts were written and shot at different times. But yeah, it gave us a lot of freedom that while, you know, going forward with a series, now the web series is a little bit more mainstream, you know, there's a lot of branded content out there, and it would potentially be possible to convince, you know, somebody to let us use their series as a promotional tool. That wasn't really the case when we started. And so this was the best route for us, I think.
Sure. Well, and it's pretty clear, I mean, that what while you might call it G&G, that it's, yeah. I mean, it's pretty obvious that you're playing D&D. If nothing else, I look at the props that you're using and I say, hey, I have that DM screen.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and for me, I mean, there's a lot of levels to it. And I really wanted the series to be, you know, a lot of kind of universal themes and sports themes, but I really wanted the series to contain a lot of, you know, esoteric content so that, you know, people who are in kind of the RPG world would have maybe an extra level of enjoyment, would be able to point to those props and say, hey, I've got that thing, you know. That was very important to me. One of the GM screens that I piled up through the series is the Ravenloft Feast of Goblins screen from mm-hmm. second edition, because that was my big campaign when I was running back in the day with my original group. As I ran a 6-year Ravenloft campaign, yeah. And so that screen was very personal to me. And you know, all the props were things that I and my brother owned. And so yeah, you'll recognize a lot of stuff through there.
Sure. Well, and I know from chatting with you a little bit that you're playing D&D pretty regularly. How much is the rest of the cast into the game?
Well, and that's one of the things that surprised me. When I started to reach out to my friends who I knew as actors and writers and, you know, behind-the-scenes cameramen and stuff like that, I was surprised how many of them were excited about the idea of a show about gaming, because they all, if they weren't actively doing it, they all had done it. And and honestly, when we started working on it, I actually hadn't actually played for several years. It's as you know, and everybody, you know, listening knows, it's a time consuming hobby. And you know, I'm out here with a day job and kind of pursuing my acting and writing. And it was rough for me to make time for it, even though I absolutely loved it. But I was surprised to find how many people were excited about it. And as we got started shooting, it started to make us all more and more hungry to play again. So when we wrapped the first season, the first thing that we did is grabbed together a bunch of guys and started a campaign almost, in fact, like a week after we wrapped. So almost immediately, it just made us all realize how much we missed it.
Sure. So there's a lot of the cast and you that actually play together then?
Everybody who's in the campaign that I'm running right now was involved in the show. It's myself and Andrew, who is my co-executive producer, and Chad, who was one of our cinematographers and our sound guy throughout, and then a bunch of the actors. We have a couple of we honestly, because, you know, I couldn't harness a crew of, you know, 8 or 9 or 10, you know, party members, I had to keep the numbers down. So there's lots of people who are chomping at the bit to jump into the game when somebody else falls out. But yeah, James, who plays Sam, is playing. Nathan, who plays Tim. Gary, who plays Charles. And Justin, who you saw for the first time in the finale as Peter Foote. They're all playing along with Andrew and Chad, and that's the party right now. So everybody's from the show.
Very cool. Yeah, and you mentioned the finale, which I just managed to watch this afternoon, and I didn't even realize until I got to the end of it, the little bits that you add on, asking for financial support and donations and that kind of thing, that we went the whole episode and Sam didn't even make an appearance until then.
We haven't actually seen Sam since episode 4. He wasn't in episode 5 either. After the big knockdown, I don't want to, spoiler alert, after the big knockdown fight, we don't see Sam for those 2 episodes. It's an important absence. His spirit is there. We actually do see Sam a little bit at the beginning of episode 6, if only his chainmail glove.
Yeah, well, and I assume that we're going to be seeing more of Sam and that storyline as you when you return for season 2.
I hope so. That's, you know, it's I don't want to give too much away of what season 2 consists of, but yeah, if we're able to do it, Sam absolutely comes back. Sam's a critical character for this series.
Okay. So we're talking about a little bit about what's going to happen here come season 2. Do you have an idea of how many seasons are planned for Gold?
Well, the original story for Gold was this 2-season arc. So season 2 completes the original story. Now, you know, should we get funding and, you know, be able to continue, there are many more stories to tell. But the original story that I wrote is a 2-season story arc. So that's the, you know, it would be sad for me if I can't at least do season 2 to finish this first story. But beyond that, there are already a lot of extra stories we want to tell. So, you know, hopefully we'd be able to continue, but at the very least, I'm hoping to close out this story.
Sure. Now, the show does have a sort of dry comedy to it. I mean, there's no slapsticky, fall down, sort of stupid, unthinking humor, that kind of thing. It's more of a, can you grasp the ludicrousness of the situation?
Right.
Sort of comedy. And I was kind of curious, what sort of inspirations do you take when working on that sort of comedy and working on that show?
Thank you for noticing that. I am a big fan of, I don't know if you watched Ricky Gervais's show Extras. Ricky Gervais, who created the original British Office, who created the show Extras, is one of my biggest heroes. And I hesitate to ever compare myself to him, but the 2-season story arc on his show Extras is really a huge inspiration for me. That very, he doesn't write a lot of jokes. I mean, they're more perhaps than Gold had, but he mostly writes really sincere characters who are in absurd relationships and absurd situations, and lets that drive his humor. And you know, for me with Gold, I didn't want to be making fun of the people who play games, partially because I am one of them, and that's my community.
Sure.
And partly because I think what little exposure role-playing games, tabletop role-playing gaming, has gotten in the mainstream media and movies and television mostly is as the butt of jokes. And I wanted the characters in the world that they live in not to treat them like they were jokes. And so having everybody have a very sincere kind of high-stakes goal, and just the whole situation and idea of the stakes of this role-playing game tournament being the driver of the comedy, my hope was really just to drive it that way. And I'm sure there are people out there for whom it isn't funny, who want something a little bit broader, and that's cool. It's not everybody's taste, but for me, that was really important, to just attack everything extraordinarily sincerely and let the comedy come from the absurdity of the stakes and the situation.
Sure. Now, are you worried that there might be some backlash from people who think that you're making fun of gaming? I mean, you do sort of play up some stereotypes of the, you know, Sam with his big chainmail, or his, was it plate or chain?
Well, he starts in the prologue, he's got the chainmail gauntlet, and then he becomes a full team member. He gets the plate mail. We didn't go into the reason that he's changed the plate gauntlet, but that's he upgrades when he gets the team membership.
But I mean, you have some of those tropes and some of those stereotypes and that kind of thing. Are you worried that there might be some backlash to that, or are we just willing to accept that, well, sometimes gamers are that way, and that's entertaining?
In the beginning, I honestly did worry a little bit. Actually, in the beginning, I worried a lot about how the community would react to the series entirely. There are a lot of people out there, companies and you know, marketing systems that are trying to reach the gaming community, especially with the video games, to a lesser extent, maybe the tabletop games, but there's plenty of crossover. And what the big mistake that all I think that most corporations make when they're addressing the community is that they're coming from the outside and they don't really understand the nature of a gamer. Not that we're a single strata, homogenous kind of group, but there are some universality. And I think the most universal thing that all of us want in content directed at us is understanding and sincerity. And so, I was worried there would be pushback in the beginning, but the community has been incredibly accepting, even on places like The Escapist, which, if you know, is a gaming magazine that's got online and offline versions. And the forums in The Escapist are notorious for just tearing stuff apart if they don't like it. And, uh-huh. I was honestly frightened. And the guys there were super welcoming. And the other RPG forums that I'm on were, I post little things about it, trying not to promote too much because obviously the community doesn't want their, boards and stuff taken over by advertisement. And so trying to walk that fine line. And honestly, everybody's been really welcoming, and I hope it's because I sincerely love tabletop role playing. I mean, I absolutely love it. And I think that comes across in the series, that it's built out of love, not out of, scorn or a sense of superiority or something.
Absolutely. Okay, well, now you have experience in the world of acting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to take a quick break for our second sponsor, but I'm going to get you involved here and
right.
test your acting ability. And I'm not going to edit a single second of the whole thing unless I'm the one that messes up. And so, but if you mess up, I'm not editing anything.
Great.
And so everybody will know exactly how you do.
Wow, this is awful.
Are you ready? All right.
Yes.
I think I gave you two lines in this.
Okay.
Although you can feel free to break in whenever. So in this break, we're going to talk about gamersaddict.com. And since we're here with David talking about gold, I thought the ideal pick for this episode would be a pair of gold-plated dice. This is where you say, but I can't afford that.
But I can't afford that.
Well, that's where you're wrong. This set of two gold-plated D6s is under $4. If you use the coupon code RADIO when purchasing your next D&D book from Gamers Attic, you get $3 off your order of $30. So let's do the math. $3 off, gold D6s that are just over $3. If you do this right, people, you can walk away with two free gold-plated dice while getting your next book and supporting the show. This is where you say, wow, that's quite a bargain.
Wow, that's quite a bargain.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Gamers Attic Attack! We have dice of every stripe, any color scheme and shape you can imagine! Exclusive dice, gold-plated dice, blank dice, label dice, cheat dice, D8 ability dice, crystal dice, time dice within dice, and jumbo foam dice for when you feel the inescapable urge to pelt your fellow players or annoying commercial announcers. And that's just a few of them! We sell enough dice to form a high-intensity plastic bridge from the Earth to the Moon! What's more, any order over $30 gets $3 off when you use the coupon code RADIO! Who wants a set?
I do.
Who else?
Ooh, me.
Anyone else?
Why are you ignoring me?
I'm not ignoring you. I'm cutting you off.
What?
You order a new set every day.
So?
Is there a 12-step program for diceaholics? Because you, sir, have a problem.
That's really strange of you to say.
Green frosted, red speckled, violet glitter, blue translucent. You couldn't say no to these beauties if you wanted to.
I'm not an addict. I could stop collecting marbles anytime I like.
Marbles? You haven't been buying marbles this whole time. You've been buying dice.
That explains why I keep losing the marbles tournament. Those 4- and 6-sided marbles aren't really all that great for rolling.
You're not only a dice junkie, you're dumb, son. Dumb.
So can I get a set?
What'll it hurt? Sure.
Woohoo! Marbles!
Remember, folks, use the coupon code RADIO to get $3 off any order over $30 at gamersaddict.com.
All right, so back to our discussion.
I hope I got the role. That's
you,
all I'm at.
You were fantastic.
I need some validation there, so I'm a needy actor.
Good. Well, I'm happy to provide you with some real broadcast experience.
Thank you.
So talk a little bit about the process for working on gold. At what point do you do the writing and how does all that happen and who's involved and then the process of filming and all of that?
Sure. It's not – building gold as a web series isn't largely different from, a lot of independent films and independent television pilots that are shot out there. We wrote everything ahead of time, and I had actually written the first three episodes not counting the prologue, episodes 1, 2, and 3, I wrote kind of myself in a closet before I showed anybody. I'm one of those nervous writers that doesn't like people to view work in progress. And so I wrote those 3 episodes and polished them up pretty well before I told anybody about it. And actually, even my writing partner, Andrew, who I write with a lot of the time, and, you know, kind of showed it around and started trying to get people excited and asking friends if they would be interested in coming with me on this journey. And I actually wrote most of the principal roles in Gold for people that I knew. You know, I have a lot of experience in front of the camera and in writing, but I didn't have as much behind the scenes experience. And so I wanted to take some of the nervousness of the process, eliminate that by writing directly for a bunch of my actor friends. And so I started to talk to them a little bit and showed it to Andrew. And, you know, he's actually the one who said, we need to write a prologue or something that comes before these first 3 episodes to explain to the world what role-playing games are. It didn't occur to me that there would be people out there who wouldn't understand the mechanics of role-playing games, but you know, that's because I'm, you know, just a huge RPG geek. So, and Andrew was absolutely right. And so he and I worked on a prologue, and we gathered people together and did a reading of the prologue in the first 3 episodes, and everybody really enjoyed it. Once they read it out loud, you know, we found where the humor was going to be and kind of figured out the tone of the show. And then I pitched it to some, you know, a director that I knew and a couple of cinematographers, and basically just kind of over the course of maybe 4 or 5 months gathered up the cast and supporting crew and staff that I needed in order to do it. And it's really I had hundreds of people. It's really a small group of people. It's basically the cast and a lot of the cast double to help me behind the scenes. And then, you know, a crew of at any given time, maybe 4 or 5 guys that are on set with us. It was really, really a lean crew. Like you pointed out before, couldn't afford to pay people, you know, ahead of time. It's all deferred. So it really was, we tried to keep it as small and simple as possible. And then we shot the prologue. Wow. We shot the prologue like almost a year and a half ago now, March of 2008, mm-hmm. Mostly to see if we could do it. We had, you know, some gear, camera and sound gear and lighting gear. And we had the script that we'd written, and we just shot it to see if we could do it, did a rough edit, and we were all pleasantly surprised that we weren't utterly deluding ourselves in thinking that we could make this series. And so then we scheduled the rest of the season, episodes 1 through 5, we scheduled to be shot over the summer of 2008, July and August, a little bit into September 2008, and then and we shot it. We shot that bulk of it up front and kind of bashed it like a film. So we were shooting a part of maybe episode 1 and episode 4 in the same day, so that we could save money on locations and save time, you know, in the crew and for our actors. And because, again, it all goes back to we weren't paying them, so we couldn't string them out over, you know, 2 or 3 months. Mm-hmm. And so it was really kind of an intense period where we went into production mode and just shot and shot and shot on the weekends and evenings because we all have day jobs, and did some rewriting on set as we were shooting and a little bit of improv here and there. And it was honestly a huge, huge blast. And then we left the season finale. I had the outline for the season finale, but I'd left it unwritten with the idea of shooting it in early 2009, largely because I wanted to see how people responded. If nobody liked it, if nobody watched it, I wanted to be able to rewrite the finale so that it was the end of the story rather than just the end of the season. But we were pleasantly, I shouldn't say surprised, but I was excited to learn that people seemed to like it. So we wrote the finale to be a season finale instead of a series finale, and we shot that this spring. And really, it's just, it's difficult to describe the process apart from we just get a bunch of friends together and, you know, try to take the process as professionally as possible, even though we're friends, and grunt it out. We worked really fast. For those of you who know film production, you know, usually you're lucky if you get 4 to 6 pages a day. I mean, that's a fast indie schedule. And we were working a lot of times 8 pages a day, which is sort of insanely fast. And I think we got away with a lot of stuff because for a lot of us, it was our first time doing this and we didn't know any better. And I think we lucked out in a lot of places. I mean, I had a phenomenal cast and fantastic crew. Everybody was really passionate. And we just, sometimes I feel like we kind of stumbled into it. I guess if you were watching it, maybe you feel like we knew what we were doing more than I let on. But it was a crazy, exhausting awesome process. And I'm so happy that I did it, and I'm excited with how it turned out.
So then are you also doing the editing work and that kind of stuff on your own, or do you have somebody that you've brought in to help with that? Or
We have there's a handful of us doing it. The episodes have been edited by those of us who are on the crew. I have an episode. I did an episode with Andrew. I did an episode with Chad. Our script supervisor on the season finale, Ashley Miller, is a brilliant editor, and we actually got her as a script super. We were lucky, but she came in after she'd seen the first part of the series, and she's a friend of a friend, and said she would like to edit, and she did just a smashing job on the season finale. And so it's everything, almost everything that was done in the series, from camera work to directing to the editing, color correction, sound mixing, which is honestly the hardest thing for an indie film, and I think that shows more than anything. It was a collaborative effort. On one episode, somebody's doing it. On another episode, somebody else is doing it. And it really, I have to just go back to how lucky I was that I was able to, I've got these incredibly talented friends who were willing to more or less volunteer their time to, and their expertise to help me bang this stuff out. So, I guess I would say that I ran the show. I was the showrunner in Hollywood parlance, but mm-hmm. I had so much help on every turn.
Great. No, and the quality comes off very good.
Oh, thank you.
There are moments where you can tell as the camera angle changes or whatever that it sounds different or the color is different or whatever. But really, that kind of stuff that you notice is few and far between. And for the most part, it looks and feels like a professional production.
Thank you so much. And actually, some of the I hear you with some of the color and sound stuff. That's we did what we could during the series to try to make it as a professional looking product as possible. It was important to all of us. Mm-hmm. Now that we've done the first season, we're talking about, and not promising, by the way, but talking about a potential DVD release. I'm talking with SAG to see what that means to those of us who are union actors. Mm-hmm. And we would love to release the first season on DVD, in part because we want it out there, in part because it could be a potential money raiser for the second season. But in order to do that, we are going to be reprocessing all of that footage, redoing the color and redoing the sound, because the forgiveness of DVD is much narrower than the web. So we will be readdressing some of those things that, honestly, that bother me as you watch the series, and that I'm sure occasionally bother our viewers as well. But we haven't gotten a lot of feedback that it bothers a lot of people. And really, I think that there's – when people realize it's such an independent production, they give us a lot of latitude, which I appreciate, because we're working our butts off here to try to make it as absolutely – production-wise professional, as well as just with the acting and the scripts and stuff, trying to keep the production professional. But the understanding that we've gotten from the community that it is an independent production is I really welcome as well.
Great. So you've talked about we've chatted a little bit about season two and how we're hopeful that season two is on the horizon. What is it going to take at this point for season two for us to know that season two is going to happen?
Gold is going to be screening at Gen Con this year in August. I'll do a little plug there. Gen Con, August, I think 13th through 17th. And we're screening on the 14th and 15th, a few episodes, and we'll have a few panel discussions. But I'm also talking to, many of the companies that are going to be at Gen Con. Even now I'm starting to reach out. Basically, we need a little bit of underwriting. We need a little bit of just monetary production support. I had saved for probably 3 years to build up the money that it took to film season one. And honestly, it wasn't in Hollywood terms, it was a drop in the bucket. And even in, kind of hobby terms, it wasn't that much money, but more than I can afford to do 2 years in a row.
And on a side note, tangent there, you must have a wonderful wife.
Yeah. Well, Shannon, actually my wife plays Martha in the series, the woman on the British team. And an extraordinary actress and incredibly understanding of my geeky hobbies and my passion for this project. So yes, she is extraordinary in many ways, and was cool, really on board with this.
Wasn't she the one in bed with somebody else in the finale?
She is in bed with Charles in the finale.
That's an interesting bit of writing that you did there.
Well, it's important for the character. She's a consummate actress. It's
great.
It's just acting, Jeff. It's just acting.
You keep telling yourself that. So you're looking to get some sponsorship and some financial support then to I guess, make sure that season two is going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. We just basically need some seed money to get started, more or less. And it's from my standpoint, it's kind of a crappy position to be in. We've got great passion for the project. We know we can do it. It's just, as so many things in this world are, as everybody knows, it's just simply a matter of cash on hand, and we just don't have it yet to start season two. And season two, the scope of season two, when we wrote the story for it, or when I wrote the story for it, I put all of the inexpensive stuff in season one because I knew that I'd be doing that on my own. And you know, season two is a little bit more expensive. There's a handful of more actual, you know, cast on screen. The world starts to open up and you see some more locations that are not just our houses. And so which will be fantastic for the series as it starts to open up and you see a little bit of a larger world, mm-hmm. but makes it, you know, more expensive. And again, we're not talking about, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, but, you know, we're talking about some more cash. And as, you know, the people who are working on the series, we're all actors and writers and with day jobs and none of us are flush. And so we just need a little help. And so I'm hoping to be able to find in the community, since season one is out there now, since I can take it around with me and show people who might be interested in, you know, underwriting an episode or even, you know, just a part of an episode or, you know, sponsoring, you know, doing some on-screen sponsorships. You know, I'm hoping I'm able to take this around and show it to people and get some of the role-playing business community excited about it. That's my hope.
Right on. Now, and I hope it's not rude to ask, but you said it's not, you're not talking tens of thousands of dollars, but most of us, I don't think, have any idea what it takes to produce anything on film. What kind of range of financial support do you need to pull off something like this?
It's honestly a little bit of a hard thing to talk about. Sure. And only because, you know, there's hard and soft costs. And, you know, we tend to, in the web television industry right now, a lot of us are talking about our hard costs, just like actually how much literally does it simply cost to shoot the thing, to get it onto, you know, hard drive or tape or whatever you're shooting on, get it edited and get it out there. And the hard costs of a series like Gold, where we don't have a lot of special effects and stuff, is actually relatively low. So on a per episode basis, our hard costs are probably a couple of grand an episode. The problem is soft costs, and those are the salaries of the people involved. And like I said, everybody mostly volunteered their time in season one, but we're all in Los Angeles for a reason, and that's because we want to make a living in our chosen field. And, you know, at a certain point, even though they're my friends, and even though, you know, I count myself among them, we're a lot of us are union actors. We're out here trying to make a living, and if we give our skills away for free all the time, we're just condemning ourselves to a life as hobbyists. And it's maybe a little harsh to say that, but, you know, I really would like to be able to consider the soft costs in second season. I really would like to be able to talk about the series as being able to pay everybody, at least a little bit, at least, you know, the kind of the minimum that they deserve for their talent. I would never be able to pay for the actual talent of the amazing people I've gathered, but to pay them so that it's not a sacrifice on their part to do it would be is sort of my dream. So, you know, it's just from a strict production cost so that we can get rolling. The money isn't large, but sure. They say that when you're talking about independent video, you should cost everything at about $1,000 a minute. Our actual hard costs are much lower than that, but if you start to consider everybody's salary, you're probably talking about that. So in that sense, you know, you are talking about probably around 10 grand an episode, but we probably could roll a lot cheaper than that. I don't want to sell anybody short, though. So that's why it's a little rough to talk about. We can shoot for a lot less, but I would love to be able to, for all these wonderful people, to pay them and myself, just for purely my time. You know, not some exorbitant Hollywood studio salary or anything, but rather just, you know, this is what my time is worth. So we'll see what happens. But that would be my dream, would be able to, you know, in the second season, be able to pay people to help me out.
Yeah, great. So you've mentioned several times now that you're playing D&D with some of the cast and the crew and your friends and that kind of stuff.
Yes.
What version of D&D are you playing right now?
We're actually doing a sort of a homebrew 3.5 combination. We're actually relying a lot on Pathfinder, on Paizo's Pathfinder product. Uh-huh. You know, my heart, you know, I said before, my heart is really a little bit more old school. First edition, second edition Dungeons and Dragons is where my heart is, but it's a little bit hard for, you know, a lot of the guys played a little bit later than I did, and we have a couple of new players. And so it's not, obviously first, second edition isn't a living game anymore. So when you're finding rule books, they're either PDF pirates, which I hate doing because I want people to get paid, or, you know, you're buying your books on eBay or whatever. But I was really excited to find Pathfinder because, you know, the Pathfinder, the it's in beta right now, but the core rulebook is dropping this fall. I'm giving Pathfinder a free plug here. So if Paizo wants to sponsor the series, they're welcome to. But the core rulebook is dropping this fall, and it's an actual living game. And the 3.0.3.5 rules, a lot of my guys were familiar with, not just because they had done tabletop games in that generation of Dungeons & Dragons, but also because they had played computer games that were based on the same rule set. So it was a really easy thing for this, you know, kind of crew with varied experiences with different games and different editions to kind of jump into together to take that, you know, Pathfinder rule set and roll with that. So, it's got a lot of homebrew rules in it, but basically we're running with Pathfinder.
So if we can talk Paizo into sponsoring Gold, will you go back and re-edit it so that everybody's playing Pathfinder?
You know, I would do my best to make it if Paizo wants to sponsor Gold and pay for my production and make it into a branded content, I'm all in. I actually love those guys.
They're really good guys to talk to.
I don't know any of them, but the product that they put out is fantastic. I'm just so impressed with, you know, just even Pathfinder, and I'm just geeky role-playing game talk, but even with Pathfinder itself, just the way that they, you know, released the beta rule set and are asking, soliciting feedback from the community as they're building the game, it's so cool. And, you know, I really appreciate that kind of a mentality in a community that is so close-knit and that's, you know, looking for content that, you know, ultimately they're going to take home with them and make part of their lives. And I think Paizo's done a really smart thing with their, with the way that they build their content.
Yeah, Paizo is one of those companies that I think is has done a better job than anybody in just about any industry at talking to their customer base and building that community and being open to them and being part of that community as they're working on products for them. I mean, they've done a great job with a lot of that, and they're very approachable in that way.
Right. And I think there's a lot of other, I don't want to shortchange other games, you know, Dungeons and Dragons fantasy, is what I love, but I know there's a lot of other games that are doing that kind of thing too. And I think the community needs that so much. You know, there's something to be said for the kind of the muscle and the marketing muscle of a larger corporation behind a game. But honestly, you know, Paizo's, as I understand it, a fairly, you know, good size in the RPG world anyway, publishing house. And it really feels like a handful of guys, you know, playing the game and, you know, looking for feedback, which is awesome.
Yeah, they're really cool. You should definitely make sure to swing by and chat with them at Gen Con.
I'm definitely hoping to.
Are you making it to any other cons this year besides Gen Con?
We've been talking about it. It's a little bit cost prohibitive. You know, when we're trying to save money for season two, it's a delicate balance to, you know, I guess the answer is I would love to. I mean, Gen Con is a childhood dream of mine. I've never actually been to Gen Con, and you know, that's, you know, for me, especially back when I was playing in junior high and stuff, I mean, that was the dream, was to be able to pack up the car and go to Gen Con, and I just never was able to do it. And so I'm incredibly honored to be included in the official program and to be screening there. And the guys at Gen Con have been super cool, and I would love to do a couple of the other cons. I don't want to shortchange anybody's con. I wanted to do PaizoCon, which I guess just happened maybe three or 4 weeks ago. I guess by the time we hear this, a couple of months ago. But I just wasn't, you know, I wasn't able to get my stuff together for that. I would love to do Dragon Con. It's becoming a really huge and important place to be. I'm not sure I'll be able to afford to do it. My brother actually just turned me on to Valley Con, which is, in the Red River Valley in North Dakota, which is where I'm from.
Oh.
Which is a gaming and comic book convention that's growing, which I might try to hit just because I can literally crash at my brother's house in order to do that. So yeah, I mean, I would love to do, there's a couple of cons actually here in the LA area that I'm going to try to hit now that the series is done shooting and we've gotten the first season out and we're on hiatus. I can turn a little bit more attention to this kind of promotion and hopefully I'll be able to do that. I mean, honestly, it's where my core audience is. And since we can't afford to do, you know, kind of wide scale internet advertising, going to the conventions and trying to get screenings, that's how we build audience. And frankly, it's just fun for me. The idea of going to gaming conventions having an excuse to go to them is just tickles me.
Yeah, I like to use this podcast as my excuse to try to get to cons, although...
You're a journalist, man. You got to be there.
So far, it's only worked for me once, you know. I made it to Origins last year, and this year I had plans to finally make it to Gen Con myself. I grew up in the Midwest in Iowa myself, and always dreamed of going to Gen Con, and a bunch of my gaming buddies actually made it one year, and my parents wouldn't let me go, Then I went off and became a teacher, and I'm usually back in school when Gen Con's happening, so I've just never been able to pull it off. And then this year, Gen Con ends, and I don't go back to school for like 2 whole days after that.
Awesome.
So I'm like, I could finally make it, and then I ended up going – I've got this plan to go to Africa for three weeks, and wife's like, you know what? You're already gone for half the summer. Taking a week off to go to Gen Con, probably not a priority, and eventually –
Well, I'll make sure to text you a lot from the floor.
That'll be great, yeah.
Let you know what you're missing.
Yeah, thanks. You know, having never been, of course, I won't have any idea what you're talking about. But.
So, well, then I'll exaggerate wildly and make you feel really terrible.
That'll be awesome. Thank you. So, speaking of texting me and what have you, we've had this sort of ongoing conversation about the interview tonight on Twitter all day. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
and so here's the big question that we've been building up to as that Twitter conversation built. We've talked about the cast and all that kind of stuff. The big question is, what kind of snacks do they eat? What is the official snack of Gold?
So here's the secret of independent production, and that's that the crew and cast eat exactly what I can afford to bring to set that week. So. When we're shooting the gaming scenes, the most popular snack, which is true of actually gaming sessions when I was a kid too, was when I brought in the bag of Funyuns. Because for me, Funyuns, it's difficult to even game without them. Even though I'm old now, I can only eat a few before I start to get queasy. That was really the official snack of my gaming youth. Funyuns and Little Debbies, and the guys really took to those on set. And then we ate a lot of because we're all getting up there in years, we ate a lot of vegetable trays. That's not an exciting snack at all.
Yeah, it's funny. I find a lot more veggie trays and, you know, bags of grapes and that kind of stuff showing up at my gaming table these days compared to back in my school days.
Well, Jeff, you reach a certain age and your body says, hey, it's 11 o'clock at night. What are you putting in me?
I hear you.
News though about being an adult though is not that I condone this for anybody underage, but being able to drink beer at the game, that's a good trade-off. I can have a beer, eat some vegetables, that's a good trade-off.
There you go. All right, so I have one more question that I planned out, and then we'll see where we go from there. But your character is Jonathan Drake.
Mm-hmm.
And we've kind of all known from the beginning that he was eventually going to rejoin the group and lead them into this tournament. And he has this sort of fan base about him, you know. They talk about how the tournament's almost not worth televising because he's not there and the fans won't watch and all that kind of stuff. And I want to know, in season two, are we going to learn step by step how to become D&D rock stars like Jonathan Drake?
Well, I think you're gonna see a little bit of it in season two. And what I would caution you, and I don't want to give too much away, but what I would caution you about the way that Jonathan feels about himself in the game is that he has a little bit of a skewed view of what's going on. Because if you think about it a bit, the people who have said that his fans are threatening to boycott are people really close to the game. So Jonathan may not be quite the rock star that he thinks he is I guess what I'll say. But that's just a little bit of a spoiler for the second season.
Oh, no.
But yeah, I think you're going to see a little bit, like I said, we're going to expand the world, I think, and you're going to see a little bit of that fan base, a little bit more of, you know, kind of the world around the people who are actually playing, providing we're able to make that second season.
So he has a skewed perception of reality, like the horrible, terrible event that took him out of the tournament to begin with.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, but I think that's part of what I wanted to, you know, I'm commenting on so many things in the series. It's so deep, Jeff. I can't even explain to you the layers upon layers.
I understand. It is.
But yeah, I think that's one of the things that happens to people. When people become celebrities, and I can say this from the outside, obviously I'm not a celebrity, but I think when people become celebrity, they become really insulated. And the things in their world that they find important and blow out of proportion, the people who are outside of that world would say, you know, dude, you fell over. you got pushed to the ground, that kind of thing happens. And so, you know, and I think you see it all the time in any kind of an insulated environment where the events in that environment become really, really important when two regular people who live their daily lives, they, you know, and for me, that's a lot of what the story is about, you know, and why I wanted to hang the Dungeons and Dragons thing on the framework of sports movies, because we can all go to the movie theater and watch, you know, a movie about, you know, the World Series or a big football game, and nobody questions why the stakes are so high. We accept that the big game, the high stakes of the big game, that's just part of our culture. And so we accept that. And so, you know, I think that all the little things surrounding that get, you know, blown out of proportion. And that's just part of the mystique of sports, of celebrity and of the way that we treat sports in this country.
Fantastic. Well, as you proceed into preparing for season two, just remember that I am available for any speaking roles that can be performed from across the country. Just, you know, just say the word and I'll be there for you.
I will keep that in mind. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank David Nett from Gold the Series for joining me on episode 111 of The Tome Show. David, if people want to find out more about Gold or you, should I send them to goldtheseries.com, or is there somewhere else they can find out what's going on?
Please go to goldtheseries.com. It's the official website of the show. We've got a blog on the site. So, again, now that production is wrapped, I'm updating the blog more often. And anything to do with the show, we will have that posted there. We also try to post about if our actors or crew are doing things, other things you might be interested in. We try to post that there, too. There's a mailing list you can sign up for. We don't spam you. We only let you know when there's stuff going on about the show. So please visit the site, sign up for the mailing list, and we'll keep you updated.
Plus, the show and you are fairly active on Twitter as well, and people can find you there.
We are. It's at Gold the Series, just like you would think, and at David Nett for myself. You can also follow at Roland Glass. If you search for it, you'll find it, for my co-executive producer. And then a couple of the actors are on there, too. You can find them by watching our tweets.
Great. Well, then I will make sure to link all of those things in the show notes so people can find them on our website. People can also email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. Visit the forums, assuming they ever actually get put back up. Maybe by the time this releases, it'll be out there. We're working on it after some pretty savage hacking. So you can also review the show on iTunes or go out and tell people about it to help the show grow. Don't forget to consider checking out the Tomes RPG shop affiliate link or the Amazon store for products discussed on the show and previous shows. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 111, Gold the Series of...
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.